and a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
Tell Sergeant Blades what the heck that could be. Okay, we'll see what's currently in yours, okay?
There's two of them, and they
stayed
in the exact same spot the whole time. They're
outdoors,
like you say that.
Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please. All right, Lisa, are you ready for this?
That what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular disc.
Well, the thing just hovering sort of 100 yards away. I could have hit it with a brick if I had gone.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that these days like these.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead. Doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
Strange day indeed. Most peculiar, Mama. Roll!
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Well, into our second year of the podcast we go with this edition, program number 455 in the current series. It's been an interesting week or so since the last SDI, most of which we will get into with Dave Berlot, British correspondent and publisher of Alien Worlds magazine Stuart Miller, and featured guest, physical trace and ongoing strangeness investigator Ted Phillips. Ted always has interestings going on in his life, and we'll get into those with him a little later. So, let's begin.
These are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Berlot.
Something new has come up recently about supposed secret meetings held by the UN to discuss the UFO phenomenon. And the report, of course, that is leaked out of these meetings looks to be of interest to everyone in the UFO community. 3 days were spent in these meetings, according to reports, which included representatives from around the world in the Vatican, and there was also a yet unconfirmed report that a confidential briefing was made by the U.S. Air Force and some unnamed branch of the National Guard during the first day. What has actually been confirmed by Gildas Bourdais in his conversations with Gilles Laurent, the man who actually claims to have been present for days 2 and 3 of the meeting, is that the question of gradual lifting of secrecy was raised, and all participants seemed to agree on that. The main thing to come out of this particular leak, and I put that in quotation marks, is that what was discussed would be the economic upheaval of various societies if the existence of UFOs were to be confirmed. In Gilles Laurent's words, sightings of UFOs increase sharply the risk of social unrest threatening the political systems of several emerging democracies. But here's the actual kicker. According to the article by Gilles Laurent, an official opening, call that an official announcement, of the UFO phenomena is to be held under 2 conditions. One, until the end of 2009, that social peace in the G8 countries is guaranteed around the liberal democratic model. And two, by the end of 2009, that the UFO sightings disturbing our neighbors continues throughout the world. Now, I actually had to read, reread, surf through various documents pertaining to all of this to be able to figure it all out. And the more I found out, the more questions I have. And it seems the more questions everybody has. But as a result of some late-breaking information, everything now has come into question because Monsieur Gilles Laurent either misrepresented himself or was misrepresented. In the articles that were written, there were claims that he was an auditor for Institut de Haute Etude de Défense Nationale, or what would translate to be the Higher Learning Institute for National Defense. It would actually be kind of like me laying claim to being a private consultant to the RAND Corporation in the United States. And before that gets heard out of context, no, I have no affiliation with any such group. Now, I'm not about to throw out the baby with the bathwater, but I have started doing a little digging of my own to try and determine if the meetings, in fact, took place and what was on the agenda. Actually, it's becoming a muddied little mess, because if you believe that Dr. Michael Sala and the spin that his exopolitical cronies put on the leak, I really couldn't fault you if you were thinking that some kind of emergency secret meeting had been called at the UN to discuss some pressing new information about UFOs, and that this was the first mention of UFOs at the United Nations. It couldn't be further from the truth on both counts. First, Gildas Bourdais has had several conversations with Jean Laurent, and according to Monsieur Laurent, the man that was supposedly present, the UFO question was only a very small part of the overall agenda, which, if anything, it actually lends much more credence to me believing that the event truly did happen. And secondly, UFOs have been discussed at the UN on multiple occasions. One of the most notable was a formal address that was given by the late astronaut Colonel Gordon Cooper in 1985. But let's look at the facts and the unconfirmed facts of what has been leaked by this UN meeting, and I'm going to address them in the form of questions. Why did the U.S. Air Force and a branch of the National Guard prepare some kind of confidential report on something that is no threat to national security? Because I do suspect that it will be confirmed soon that they in fact did, and the information contained in the report really was some kind of catalyst that convinced three U.S. senators to ask for two more days of meetings to discuss the whole thing. The statement that actually blows me away that's come out of this is the question of gradual lifting of secrecy was raised, and all participants seem to agree on that. Does anyone else other than me actually realize what that means? Firstly, it means that the representatives of these countries admit that there is a veil of secrecy over the UFO-related information. That goes further by them actually admitting the information about UFOs does exist. Ergo, if there's information about something, it must exist. There's no need to have a gradual lifting of secrecy on something that really doesn't exist, is there? Now, the final part that threw me was the group at large coming to some kind of a conclusion that an official opening or an official announcement is going to be held under two conditions. One being that the social peace is maintained in the G8 countries, and the other that UFO reports are actually going to continue until the end of 2009. Now think about that for a second. We're not talking about a gradual lifting of secrecy. We're talking about an official statement, an official opening, as it's been called or translated. Countries coming forward admitting that, well, we've been hiding a lot of stuff for all these decades, and here it is. Mind you, if we begin getting a worldwide rash of sightings over what amounts to a little over a year and a half, they're really not going to have much of a choice whether or not we have rioting in the streets. If this particular meeting has taken place, and if the subject of UFOs has been discussed on the agenda regarding their impact on social economics of our society, it means the countries of the world are admitting that UFOs are real. Because how can you have an impact on society if it doesn't exist? But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange Days, indeed.
Oh, yes, as always, Dave Furlong, nicely done. A couple of things to add to your take on the secret UFO meetings at the UN. I always wait with bated breath to see how unknowncountry.com comes up in reaction to major UFO announcements. As you well know, it's the first place I go to, unknowncountry.com, Whitley Strieber's website. On Saturday, the 8th of March, 2008, Whitley Strieber posted to his website, unknowncountry.com, the sensational story that a meeting had taken place at the United Nations among the G8 countries concerning a possible change to a policy of disclosure in 2009 now appears to have been, according to the president of the French National UFO Research Organization, a fiction. Oh, UnknownCountry.com's position is this, the website says. Until there is concrete evidence of the meeting provided by one of the alleged official participants, the assumption must be that it never happened. That makes me feel so much better.
Because it was reported as being only a small portion of the agenda, that's something that leads credence. Whether it took place or not, yeah. The only thing is we're going to need somebody that can actually confirm they were really there. It's as simple as that.
Not quite, because Robert Morningstar, who contributes a lot of stuff to the UFO Digest website out of Hamilton, Ontario, here in Canada, says, please note that they are attacking his credentials, not the information. It is very curious how Laurent has worked there for years with the same creds, and no one has attacked him until now.
And that's the one that throws me, though. And it really does throw me. Why do people feel it's necessary to do that type of thing? Like, if he actually is, and it's whether or not he is actually saying, yes, he's an auditor for this particular group or not. If he's saying that, it boggles my mind. Why? You don't need to.
You see, according to Michael Sala, there were two other sources to this story.
Yes. Yeah, I'd love to know who those sources were.
Excuse me while I clear my throat.
Uh-huh. You know, it's the old rule of journalism. You have to have three real sources. Now, whether or not he has three real sources.
Well, according to him, only two.
Two, including Gillenor?
We don't know. And we've heard very little out of Dr. Michael Sala about this, other than to just reiterate what he said. And, of course, he was the one who labeled it a secret UFO meeting.
Yes, I like that. At the UN.
Yes, just adding to his credibility and that of exopolitics all over the place. And I could go on and on about exopolitics, but I shall restrain myself.
Oh, I have no problem whatsoever in going on about exopolitics.
Well, I probably will with Stuart Miller a little later on. We'll see.
God, I love that group. Not.
Well, I thought it was interesting that the Exopolitics Toronto crowd sent a copy of the DVD Fastwalker, which has all kinds of credible people in it, like Sean David Morton and Richard Boylan.
Oh, Lord.
Sent a copy of that documentary to every member of Parliament and every member of the Senate here in Canada. I wonder where they got that idea from. It seems to me that a few years ago on Strange Days Indeed, we had talked about sending an audio CD to every member of Parliament and the Senate here in Canada.
I honestly believe that we would have edited a smidge more.
Oh, we definitely would have included Richard Boylan and and Sean David Morton and Wendell Stevens. And why not send them a copy of Paul Kimball's The Best Evidence? Why not send them a copy of Out of the Blue, the way a Belgian guy did to the Belgian Parliament?
Exactly, like something that actually has some credibility to it, some reality to it, as opposed to, oh, God.
Oh, well, exopolitics, showbiz, and I'm sure that Canada's former defense minister was greatly impressed by that documentary.
I think we're bashing.
Oh, no. Why would we have any reason at all to bash?
You know how I feel about my favorite Men in Black documentary aficionados.
They thought Men in Black was a documentary. Yeah.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I swear to God that they got a lot of their theories out of Men in Black.
It's really unfortunate because there are some quite bright people there with some quite good ideas.
Yes.
Theirs is the new way and theirs is the wrong way, it would appear.
Yes.
By their own making, it's the wrong way. However, we must not mock the afflicted, Dave Perlett. And you and I have both worked with one or two of them.
That's true. And in all
and they're basically lovely people who just blew me away when they turned around and done what they've done. So
yeah.
I think we covered that off fairly well.
Oh, I suspect we have.
It'll be actually very interesting to see what transpires with this so-called UN meeting and the two sources that Michael Sala has, and in fact they do come forward, and if anybody can get the minutes of those meetings from the United Nations.
Oh, wouldn't that be nice?
Wouldn't
it? It would be lovely to see something like that.
Yes.
Because the thing is, we do have official documents out of real UFO discussions that have been held at the UN and addresses. We do have available the actual address by Gordon Cooper, his words and his thoughts. I'm going to be damn blunt here. There is no reason that they would have anything secret about UFOs at the UN. They've been forthcoming with every bloody thing that they've had in regards to other UFO situations. So why would they bother to make it all so secret this time?
Well, it would be probably at the request of the unnamed Air National Guard unit.
Yes. Yes, true. Oh, God.
Oh, God, it's time to stop, Dave.
Yes, it is.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
We'll talk soon.
For sure.
Bye.
Bye.
A couple of programs, we cross the Atlantic to Cheshire in the United Kingdom. A British correspondent lives there, a British correspondent, Stuart Miller, who is now the proud papa of a brand new, very tasty, glossy magazine called Alien Worlds. Got my first copy, for which I want to thank you, Stuart, and congratulate you on a wonderful product. It's so good. Well done. Well done.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'm glad you liked it, Errol.
Very much. And it fills in a gap between astronomy and physics and most of science and ufology.
Having used all those long words, I want to ask you, was it readable?
Very much so.
Well, I didn't want to create the impression that it had words of 100 syllables and all that, you know. And you need to bear in mind as well, it's written by somebody who doesn't know one end of a Bunsen burner from another, so, or edited by
Oh, who would be that person then?
That would be me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I really was actually an absolute dunce at science at school.
Well, me too. It's an excellent publication, Stuart.
Thank you.
And quite looking forward to the next issue. What's the response been like to the first one?
Critically, the response has been quite good. Just trying to think if I've had anything negative said. Yeah, I did, actually. I got a most bizarre letter from somebody in the south of England that I think rubbished everything. It was weird. It really was. But you'll get to read it because I thought the letter was so good because it was so bad. I'm going to publish it.
Oh, good.
Other than that, there's certainly been no seriously constructive...
I didn't think there would be.
In some ways, I suppose I prefer to be told, well, you know, it was okay, but this could have been better, or that could have been, or I didn't care for that. That's actually quite welcome, that sort of feedback. The critical word is constructive.
In the course of my daily phone calls around North America, I have several times been asked, when's Miller's magazine coming over here?
I don't know. I really have actually been unable to define exactly what penetration into North America I got, other than the fact that Barnes & Noble took it, but that certainly doesn't mean it's available in every store. I think Borders took it, but I don't know about that. And I know another retail chain took some. I can't remember their name, But whether that just stayed in America or whether it crept across the border, I don't know.
None of the names of those companies that you mentioned actually come into Canada, I don't believe.
But Borders even have stores in the UK, although they have just sold them. But surely they must be in Canada.
No. Our main one here is Indigo Books, the major book chain. Yeah.
Borders came over a few years ago, but I can only presume that it wasn't as successful for them as perhaps they wanted. That they sold it out to a large financial group, actually, with no particular expertise in book retailing. But they've only had it a few months, but they seem to be doing okay. Borders, actually, are quite nice places to go into because they usually have a cafe or coffee shop.
Well, much like Indigo up here. And nice big stuffed armchairs, and people catch up on their magazine reading.
Indeed.
Well, of course, people can always subscribe directly and have it come through the mail, which is always a good way of ensuring that you get copies of your favorite publications.
Indeed, and thank you for mentioning it, and thank you also to the surprisingly large number of people that have done that, actually. Yes, I am very grateful and also pleasantly surprised by the relatively large number of people that have subscribed.
It keeps your packaging stuffer fairly busy and licky stamping.
Well, you're speaking to him, yes.
Yeah, that's what I thought. There's nothing like starting out in your one-man operation. Oh, my. Yeah, believe
me, actually,
I know.
It's fairly easy. Mm-hmm. It's not that time-consuming.
Oh, good.
Well, when you've got printers, and I mean, probably the worst part, and I exaggerate by describing it as the worst part, is simply just transferring the address onto the computer. Mm-hmm. After that, it's pretty straightforward.
Oh. You vacation in France on a fairly regular basis, don't you?
Correct.
Do you speak French?
Absolutely not.
Ah. So asking you whether you read French is fairly futile.
Not really. I wouldn't say that my comprehension is 100%, but I can certainly probably get the gist of the sense of the meaning of a French article. Why do you ask?
I'm sure you've been keeping up with what's been going on and the secret UFO meeting at the United Nations. I'm sure you've come across in the last few days.
Just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I wondered if that had piqued your curiosity any.
Actually, the effect it's had on me has been to depress me somewhat, I'm afraid. It's almost as if the lunatics have taken over the asylum at the moment.
Once again, yes.
Well, albeit, hopefully, just for a temporary period. I think it might pay to stand back, if possible, and take a broader perspective of this in terms of where it's happening in the sequence of recent events, and I'm referring to Stevensville, Dublin. I have found it very depressing for the reason that you actually mentioned on List the other day, which was the fact that the exo-politics crowd has sort of jumped in and hijacked it to their own benefit. I'm caught between sort of really condemning some people and not wanting to sound too harsh, but I'm a bit disappointed with Robert Morningstar. I think that people like Vince White, I think Franklin Fields, and I think James Horrock, by and large, between them, talk absolute rubbish, particularly Vince White. And the one thing that seems to just run through a good part of their emails, particularly Mr. White's, is that they just make stuff up. I have in mind a recent piece I read from Vince White that I think is going to appear in UFO Digest on their website. And I read that and I thought, well, how do you know all this? Because he makes sort of various claims and so on in terms of how disclosure is going to occur.
Mm.
Because nowhere does it say that it's suppositional, that this is how it might work out. He said, this is going to happen, that's going to happen. And the only answer you can come to is, well, you're just making this dribble up.
Well, that's what I thought when he sent it to me last week.
And you didn't publish it?
I didn't publish it, no. Because it would just start up another storm. And I think the problem with people like Franklin Fields, a lawyer and former military captain, and Vince White and Horak, is that they're not aware of the UFO history. And,
I think you're right.
And the way it is, there's much of that UFO history is in the archives at UFO Updates, and you only have to pop in a couple of search words, and you can read all about it. And that's a thing that has been happening, I've noticed, of late, on a fairly consistent basis. People ask questions that were answered 7-8 years ago on the list and are in the archive.
To be honest, I'm not sure that some people would be particularly interested in reading the archives. I don't think they're interested in the history, because they're interested in the present paradigm. They're interested in what seems to be happening now and the fact that they're right at the heart, or seemingly so, of what might turn out to be disclosure. And what was happening 30 years ago, or 20 or 10 years ago...
at the United Nations.
Worked through, yes. Isn't really relevant to them. There was one sense of irony a couple of weeks ago when either Mr. Horak or Mr. Fields started to castigate the old guard on UFO updates, and by implication, Dick Hall, Jerry Clark, etc., etc. And at the other end, the opposite end, you've got the people looking for a more radical approach to UFOs these days, as exemplified by Paul Kimball. And there's the old guard tend to get hammered at that end of it as well.
Yes.
And I just find that somewhat ironic that the old-timers in the middle are getting it from both sides.
As if it's the fault of the old-timers that nothing has come out of their years and years and years of investigation and research.
I don't mean to leave this subject. The way that you said that reminded me of the fact that last night here in the UK, I had on my TV screen Frank Drake, the astronomer, who effectively was saying the same thing. After 50 years at this game, he's still got nothing to show for it. So it's not something that's just restricted to ufology per se, but it stretches right across the whole spectrum of the search for extraterrestrial life.
And even in Frank Drake's field, there's so much rehashing of old facts and research that goes on right now even. It's exactly the same thing that happens in the UFO field.
I'm not sure you can make that comparison, because they are science-led and benefit from the advancements in science. So, yes, okay, Frank Drake has been at it for 50 years and hasn't got anything to show for it. But on the one hand, there are new massive telescopes being built and planned for the very near future. They're sticking Kepler up in space. You know, I think that Seth Shostak might be right in one aspect, which is that he says, well, you know, I think man will make contact with intelligent extraterrestrials within the next 50 years or so. I think that figure varies depending on what day you catch him on. But broadly speaking, he's right, simply because the technology will have developed to such a point that if indeed there is anything there, we will be able to detect it.
Or it'll show up here.
Indeed.
First.
Indeed.
Or make itself known officially first.
Well, indeed, yes. But can we look that far ahead in ufology? I don't think we can.
Well, not with any clarity, without any sort of conviction, with any sort of authority.
No, I think we just sit here, pouncing on every new case that comes along that shows some interest. But in the end, because a good many people seem to think that there is some element of government cover-up or compliance in this, you know, I'm not talking just about people that think there's a major conspiracy, but even if you move to the other end of the spectrum a bit, there's still a lot of people that think, well, the government knows something, you know, even if what they know is what they don't know. In the end, then, you're not absolving yourself a responsibility, but you're allowing the subject to be taken out of your control, whereas I guess the astronomers are being proactive. SETI's been lucky in the sense that they've had somebody like Paul Allen come along, although what I didn't know was that he hasn't funded or financed the whole of the Allen Array, the new telescope range that's opened up a few months back just north of San Francisco. He's funded so much of it, but he's looking for somebody else to come in and partner him. So they haven't got the whole thing up and running by any means, by a long way. But NASA going about it with spacecraft, but yeah, we don't in ufology. Or when we have had, like Bigelow, they've sort of come in and messed about and not really told anybody what they're doing and then disappeared again.
Into space, in Bigelow's case. Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah.
You know, I mentioned that Frank Drake was on my TV screen here in the UK last night. It was a moderately interesting program. Told me one or two little things I didn't know about. Called Are We Alone in the Universe, the BBC Horizon program, and seemed mainly to be partly a tribute to Frank Drake, but also just rehashing the stuff about Gliese 561c, which was the first Earth-like extrasolar planet discovered last year. Lots of exoplanets have been discovered, but this is the first one that is actually Earth-like. In other words, isn't a big gas giant. And they look quite seriously at the question of whether there could be life up there. On balance, probably not. Its gravity is 10 times denser than ours. It doesn't rotate. It's fixed in its orbit, very close to its star. So one side of the planet is very hot, the other is very cold. But one thing that they said that I had completely missed was that they discovered another one up there in the same system, which they've called Gliese 561D, which is at the opposite end of the scale and is just on the outer edge of the Goldilocks zone. So there could be life there, but it's cold.
And I want to point out, Stuart, for the sake of the listener who does not know who Frank Drake is, and I can't imagine that there are many listeners who don't know who he is anymore. He was the guy who worked out the equation that figured out how many potentially habitable planets there might be out there in the cosmos.
Indeed.
And as a result of that equation, we've been able to figure that there might potentially be hundreds, if not thousands, if not tens of thousands of habitable planets out there.
Well, where are they?
Well, exactly.
Where are they, Errol?
Well, it's the enormity of space, mate, that does it. The number of times I've sat down and tried to visualize just how far the end of our universe is, let alone the end of all the other universes that butt up against ours, and my mind just starts to boggle.
Well, I congratulate you for even trying to think about it, because quite frankly, when you look at the figures, I guess they're only approximations, but it's impossible, but it's very difficult for the mind to sort of get a handle around it.
How many atoms and molecules make up this desk? And is it possible that you and I and the rest of our cosmos is part of somebody's desk in somebody's office somewhere?
Would it matter if that was the case?
Well, there's not much I could do about it.
No,
I just go, oh, well, shrug my shoulders and continue on, the way most people would were we to get full disclosure on the UFO enigma.
I must say, I think that it's interesting just how few people are getting involved in this conversation, which I think really underlines what most people probably think about it. I just wish it would go away. I'm finding it irritating, and I think for sure it ain't going to happen. You know that as sure as night follows day. It ain't going to happen, and so it's just a pile of rubbish.
Which brings us around for the apparent raison d'etre of exopolitics, which we mentioned earlier on. One of their contentions is that they're there to negotiate or to talk to the aliens. Wait a minute, where are the aliens that we need to talk to?
Errol, please don't be picky. That's just a detail. I don't have any sympathies for the exopolitical movement, but I can kind of understand how it got going. I think it came about through impatience. People just, look, we know, even though we can't prove it, but we know that Earth is being visited by aliens. So let's cut this rubbish out about proof and about so on and so forth. I don't make those remarks dismissively. And let's just deal with the reality that we know. Can you blame people for being impatient? Well, yes, I guess you can. But by the same token, there are lots of questions that go unanswered. The exopolitical crowd don't want to wait. They're making an assumption and have moved forward on that basis. And at least from the point of view of the fact that I understand why they are the way they are, I can see where they're coming from on that. The rest of it is just, well.
And then they associate themselves with people like Greer, and they associate themselves with the former Minister of Defense for Canada, who offers absolutely nothing, nothing to the work that's been done over the last 50, 60, 70 years. And all it does is it tends to make all of the old-timers that the exopolitical crowd are impatient with, it frustrates them and makes the exopolitical crowd look like a bunch of bananas, which a lot of them are. They've stopped taking their meds.
Sorry, are we talking about the old-timers or about the exopolitical crowd?
The exopolitical crowd.
Right. I know who you have in mind when you make that remark.
And believe me, Michael Sala was not the founder of exopolitics, which he seems to be taking the credit for nowadays.
Yes, it was going before him, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Started, I think, yes, you say, in your backyard. Are the exopolitical crowd any different in relationship to mainstream ufology than, say, 50 years ago, the contactees were. Because the contactees were eventually rubbished by people who were interested in serious ufology.
And still a source of embarrassment to mainstream UFO research.
What, contactees?
Yes.
To be honest, I think there's been an almost revisionist attitude towards them in some ways. People will still sit here and say, yes, they're all liars, or they were mistaken, or they were fools, or they were taken in, or whatever. But I think that the passage of time has sort of attached a certain romanticism to them now, and people almost sort of fondly look back at that time as if, well, it was like the beginning of modern ufology, and it all sort of added to the excitement. Yes, you'll get people condemning them, but not unless they're prodded, if you know what I mean. You don't get people stepping forward in these days and saying, well, the contactees were idiots. You do get people stepping forward these days saying, well, exopolitics is just a load of rubbish.
Yeah, well, it's like the Billy Myerons.
Yeah, you're quite right. This side of it is just never going to go away. It's always going to be there, and that is part and parcel of what ufology is all about. And yeah, I know a lot of us don't feel comfortable with it, but it's going to be there. Can I mention a name to look out for? He's just published a book. Not the first, but this one is by far and away the most interesting one. The gentleman's name is Jeffrey Bennett, and the book he's published, which is just out now actually, is called Beyond UFOs, The Search for Extraterrestrial Life and Its Astonishing Implications for Our Future. Jeffrey is variously described as an astrophysicist, cosmologist, but he told me he was an astronomer. I have spoken to him. PhDs, worked at NASA, serious scientist. These days he writes a fair number of children's scientific books as well. He also co-wrote Life in the Universe with Seth Shostak about 3 years or so ago. A very interesting guy, a hardline scientist, but by the same token, not adverse to discussing UFOs with people. He'll listen with an open mind. He's not someone that will dismiss it outright. Yes, it could be. His thinking with UFOs is that it's not new thinking, but if we are being visited, then the likelihood is, and I think this falls back into Drake here, civilizations could emerge, or probably emerge, in the region maybe once every 50,000 years. Intelligent civilizations. On that basis, if they get past a certain point where they might, point we're rapidly reaching actually, where they might actually destroy themselves and survive beyond that, and they work their way into space properly. It means, and obviously these are very broad, bland figures in some ways, but that if anything is visiting us here, they will be approximately about 50,000 years ahead of us. Interestingly, Jeff does not think that we've discovered everything we possibly can about physics. He thinks that there's still a way to go. But he thinks there might be some laws of physics that an advanced race and 50,000 years ahead of us is a very, 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 very long way. I mean, beyond our realms of imagination. But he thinks that even if you take a civilization that advanced, there might still be some parts of physics that they simply can't get round. And he suggests that it's possible that people have seen things, even if there have been attempts to disguise a presence. It's possible that people have caught glimpses here and there of things that, you know, maybe they weren't supposed to see, that sort of thing. And he pumps that up, so to speak, as a very sort of partial, quasi-explanation, maybe, for some things that some people have seen. He doesn't rule out the possibility, but of course it comes down to proof.
Yes.
Very interesting guy to talk to, interesting ideas, very well-written book. I think the book is getting well-received as well. I think it's a very clever title.
What is that title again?
Beyond UFOs, The Search for Extraterrestrial Life and Its Astonishing Implications for Our Future.
My brain boggles in the same way that I'm trying to look at the edge of the universe when I think about a civilization that's 50,000 years ahead of us. That would explain everything that's been going on around us for the last several centuries.
Yes. One thing, for example, that a lot of people throw up is, well, why would, say, a civilization that advanced come here? What could there be of possible interest about us?
Day trippers coming back through time.
Jeff, and I certainly agree with him on this, thinks we'd be absolutely riveting, of real interest in terms of how we are. And just, it doesn't mean that life is replicated or behavior is replicated exactly the same on different planets where intelligent life has grown up. We could be just completely different to what they know, however basic or primitive we might appear to be. And I think we would be of very great interest to any intelligent species.
We have our own zoos, don't we?
Indeed.
And our labs, where we experiment on creatures supposedly less intelligent than us, less able to defend themselves without their permission. And this topic has come up in relation to abductions over the years on Strange Days Indeed.
Yes, but the whole process could be just mirrored further and further back, and we don't feel like we're being experimented on, do we?
Some of us do.
Yes, that's true. I think we feel that's Earth-related, though.
No, not at all. You listen to the likes of Katharina Wilson, Dave Jacobs, John Velez, Bud Hopkins, and many, many abductees. They certainly do feel as if they're being experimented on.
Mm.
Mm.
I don't know if you're aware of it, but our good friend Mac Tonnies recently got himself a gig writing for a SETI blog.
Oh.
I don't know if he's getting paid for it. I think he might be, but that's by the by. And it's not actually an official SETI blog. I'm not quite sure, but the blog is about SETI. And he's been putting up one or two interesting pieces up there, and he's just stuck something up called the SETI Institute and UFOs. Basically, Mac has a go in it at Seth Substack.
Surely not.
Oh, yes, he does. He could have agreed with him, but no, he has a go at him. He reckons that Seth's logic isn't very sound. His rebuttals aren't very sound. I think he could have gone for the throat a bit more. I think he could have absolutely ripped. But my reason for mentioning it is look out for it.
Do you have that blog name, blog address, Stuart?
I do. It's actually called the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. The URL is actually very simple, SETI.com. This is not the official SETI organization. And if you hunt around for Mac's work on there, you should find it. And it's worth reading. He's quite an interesting writer.
Yeah, Mac Tonnies, who has been on this program in the past, has done a couple of conferences now. Still does, in fact, have his own blog. He's a good friend of yours and Paul Kimball's and Greg Bishop and Nick Redfern, as I recall.
It's a bit on the edge. We've had a couple of strange stories in the UK in the last couple of days. The one that's broken today is in the Grantham Journal, Grantham being a town in Lincolnshire. They've been running quite a few UFO stories lately. There seems to have been one or two sightings, and they've run with them. But today's headline reads, "Reader tries to pass off fake UFO picture." And all the story is some bloke, who they name, Wayne Mills, brought into the newspaper a picture of a UFO, which he claimed he'd seen over the town. And in fact, the paper reprints it, so it does rather defeat the object of the exercise in many ways. But he told the paper it was just hovering there. It was like a fireball, but it was moving up and down. But the newspaper identified the picture as one being taken in 1994 by a Mexican gentleman called Carlos Diaz. So it was a photo taken at the eruption of Mount a volcano in Mexico.
Popocatépetl.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, that's quite right, yeah.
I know I'm mispronouncing it for the Jaime Masons of the planet.
Well, that wasn't a bad effort. But fancy just wandering into a newspaper, bring down a photograph, saying, "Hey, this is a UFO above our local town." And then they write him up in the paper and say, "Well, he's a fake."
Isn't it good that whoever it was at the newspaper who was responsible took the responsibility to see if he could find out what that picture was actually of? They actually did some research.
Yes, well done for pointing that out, because we are very quick to jump on the press as being sort of very poor. So somebody in some little local regional newspaper actually pulled their finger out and did some work. Well, well done.
Well done then. Good. The Grantham News saved us a lot of work and grief.
The other story, which appeared a few days ago, was about a sighting in a suburb in London. The way it was written up was very funny. The headline ran something along the lines of, "Ministry of Defense quells panic after UFO sighting."
Oh, yes, I read that.
And it was a bit of an overstatement, because naturally the paper did ring the MOD up for a quote, and I wouldn't say they quoted the MOD out of context, but they did, I guess. But what was interesting as well, it wasn't just that, but construction worker Daryl Greenway, who is 19 and who lives in Woodford Green, which was the area of London where I did, he told the paper that he thought that an alien invasion was about to happen. And he feels that everybody's covering it up.
Yeah, I think I posted that story actually to the list.
Yes.
Grinning as I did so, yeah.
So it's nice to know that eccentricity hasn't totally left the UFO field just yet.
I think in any potential UFO sighting, one has to remember the words that were written in large, warm, friendly letters on the front of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Don't panic. Thank you, Doug. Well, I guess on that note of levity, Stuart Miller, that wraps up your contribution to this program this time.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure as usual, Errol. It's always enjoyable.
And for me, too. And how long do we have to wait now until the next edition of Alien Worlds magazine, which people can subscribe to at alienworldsmagazine.com?
Just over 4 weeks.
Look forward to it, as I know a lot of the listeners do. And listener, do yourself a favor, go subscribe to it. If you've never subscribed to a magazine before, Alien Worlds is the one to start with. You'll be fascinated by it. I know I was, and many of the readers who have actually seen it here in North America also are. And well done, Stuart. Thank you, sir.
And thank you, Al. Bye-bye.
It's been many months since our featured guest on this edition of Strange Days Indeed has been with us. He is renowned for his work in physical trace evidence research. He was the protege of J. Allen Hynek. J. Allen used to refer to him as Theodore, and a lot of people have asked, who the hell is Theodore? Well, let me tell you, dear listener, Theodore is our guest. Ted Phillips joins us from his home in Music City, Missouri. Branson is where he is at. Ted, it's been a long time.
Well, it has, yes. And it's, as always, a pleasure to visit with
you. It's wonderful to have you with us, because whenever you're on and people go, oh, Ted Phillips, gotta listen to that one. In the archives as they are at the moment, I think probably the programs that you've been on, there have been a large number of downloads. I think probably because you're the only one who is seriously interested in physical trace evidence. And then, of course, there's the fascinating story of the Tatra Cave in Slovakia. Perhaps we can touch on that, although we can always point the listener to go to the archive and listen there so that we don't spend a lot of this program repeating ourselves. Since last you and I have talked, you have set up a new website, ufophysical.com, the Center for Physical Trace Research. You have put together a research team. Part of your team is someone who's really into web design and has designed a very tasty website for ufophysical.com.
Yes, indeed. Adam Johnson. He's the very young guy on the team. I suppose the rest of us at our current ages, it's good to have a young guy.
Most of the guys who are doing web design are now young guys.
Exactly.
Not stuck in the old habits the way people like me are.
Yeah, this is amazing technology, and gosh, I wish we could have had this back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Oh, you would have had a lot of people sitting around on their asses doing nothing. Armchair researchers.
Yeah, that's true. But I look at things like expert GPS software and Google Earth. If we're going into an area that we've not been before, you know exactly what you're going to run into when you get there. And you can carry the images with you on a laptop or smaller devices, and it makes the job much, much easier. And figuring out distances to certain points and so on, it's wonderful. And it's great to be able to use the digital imaging in contrast to the many years that I stood in a light-tight, airtight dark room, chain smoking and breathing chemical fumes.
Yes, good buzz.
Well, it was at the time. It's not so good now. But
no.
Anyway, you can do incredible things with the digital format if you're very careful not to start faking things out that you couldn't possibly do with an enlarger in a dark room. And so I love it.
Yeah, and of course, as has been lamented many, many times, damn Photoshop.
Yes. There is that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, we just have to really stay on our toes a lot more now. Trickery was pretty visible on the old film format. And now it takes a rather discerning eye and a good deal of time to ferret out things that are not.
Mm-hmm.
But keeps you on your toes. It's interesting, and it's a marvelous process.
I think that probably the last time we talked, you had amassed a database of physical trace evidence that was up in the, I guess, getting close to the 4,000, huh?
I think back when we were talking, it was around 3,300 cases, and it's not really gone up that much. It's at 3,387 trace landings from 92 countries.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a substantial number. We have to remember, when I say trace landing cases, these are only reports where an object was seen generating the traces. This is not a crop circle. It is not an interesting spot that someone runs across, but no object can be placed there. If those were all in there, then we would have, I suspect, several thousand more. But what I'm looking for is solid, hardcore data, not numbers. At one time, I was carrying a separate catalog, which I do if I get a report of a very interesting site that's found, or an anomaly is found, but no object related to it, and it seems to be quite similar to known UFO sites, then I file that in a separate catalog, just in case the trend continues and then you come up with an object leaving precisely that type of site. And although you can't directly link it to a UFO case, it's of great interest. So I am a person very solidly into the thought that we need not muddle UFO research with the Loch Ness Monster, Bigfoot, and Lord only knows what else has been thrown into this mix. What happens there is you continue to push science away from any possible consideration of the subject. They're looking for solid information. Well, they're not looking for it. But if we can amass enough of it at some point in the future, I think it'll have to be taken seriously. So that's what I'm accumulating all this stuff for. Not that I expect some vast investigation today, but someday in the future, all this may be of some use.
Oh, I hope so. I hope that a lot of people's research has not gone in vain.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely so.
Since we last talked, have you come across anything that has taken your breath away?
Well, one thing that's certainly taking my breath away right now, and it has been really for the last, I guess, almost 10 years, is what we call the Marley Woods site, which is an area consisting primarily of three ranches in very isolated areas. They adjoin themselves north to south, and since December of 1998, we've had very close observations by extremely credible people. Right now, I have on file from that area 193 witnesses,
whoa,
not one of which has ever gone public. And that says a lot, I believe, to the credibility of these people, because they're not looking for publicity. And most folks don't make up a huge lie and not tell anyone. not only that, a considerable amount of this stuff is backed up with video and still shots taken by primarily the owner of one of the sites, because after all this started, he and his wife were so puzzled that he went out and bought a not really great video camera, but at least it captured things. Then he upgraded to a little better video camera, which better captures some of these things. So we're investigating that. My little group, the SIU, was developed in January of last year, primarily to kind of get out of this mode of going in behind things and picking up breadcrumbs, to try to insert ourselves into the middle of active stuff.
And how successful have you been at that?
Well, we have had some success. We've been going to the Marley Woods now since April of last year, gathering a lot of stories, a lot of information. But on November the 16th and again on the 17th, we were able to image on three CCD units an object which is kind of a singular piece of the puzzle there called the North Mystery Light. The owners named it that because it always begins its appearance in about the same spot, but it does a lot of different things. They had captured it on video before, and since 1999, this thing has been seen almost 100 times, and it just happened we had everything set up, and there it was. I happened to be standing away from one of the units with a pair of binoculars and got a really good look at it. Unbeknownst to me, I had photographed this thing with a 35-millimeter camera back in 2000. I didn't realize that it was this particular type of display at the time, and went back through the photos, and sure enough, it looked exactly like the photo through the binoculars, which is a very odd sort of yellow-orange color. It's very bright, but it's soft in appearance. The entire form, which is oval, horizontally, a big egg sitting there. And it was totally stationary for a minute and 4 seconds as we obtained the video of it. So this thing, what appears to be the same object or same type of object, has been seen by up to 17 witnesses on occasion, climbing from its point of origin high up into the sky, all the way from due north to east of the farm, where it would hover for various periods of time in line with and behind an old barn, and then would just disappear. As I went back through all the cases, I started finding that there is a south light of the same type, and the color is so dramatic, and on occasion, this thing gets huge. Of course, no sound, nothing to indicate what it might be. In certain periods of time, there would be the observation of this object south of the farm, and it would be stationary for sometimes 3 minutes, and it would start climbing. Then it would slowly crawl across the sky, and when it reached this old barn area, it would wink out, and instantly the north one would come on and start moving towards the south and would wink out at the same spot. And it's that sort of weirdness that's going on, along with many other things. So we're very busy. We have the total cooperation of the property owners. And the instant that they see something, they call us. And typically, these occurrences will run several nights in a row. So we have the opportunity to get there, get on site, get the equipment set up, and start imaging. So we're very much looking forward this year to being in a position to get a lot of good imaging and data from these things.
Now, presumably this area is relatively close to you and your team.
It's a considerable distance.
Ah.
It's several hours.
It's not in Missouri.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
The only reason I have to be very careful is that the 193 witnesses who have not gone public are telling us about this stuff and allowing us on these sites only if we do not reveal the location or their names, because the last thing they want, and you know what would happen.
Oh, you'd have day trippers down there every day.
Yeah, bus tours. I hope at some point all this can be brought to light in some way without harming those people or their properties. Now, what we are doing on the website is we are posting all of the data that we acquire in almost real time because we want people to see what we're seeing. We want them to see what's going on. I don't believe in this dumping everything in a black hole and keeping it to yourself. There's no point in that. Because of this, we now have a second and very similar site, 60 miles from the original Marley, and we have been able to track those sightings back to the year 1937. That's when they were first seen. And they've been seen rather continuously up through that period. And also at Marley, we've been able to track back to witnesses 70 years ago that were seeing this stuff. Of course, the first thing that comes to most of the researchers' minds is, oh, well, this is military stuff. Well, 1937, I don't think so.
And neither is it ball lightning.
No, because these things are not traveling along a fence. They're not traveling along the ground, although they do make ground contact on occasion, but then they ascend or they descend to the ground, ascend again and fly away and so on. And they're seen for long periods of time. One of the things that really intrigues me are the small light balls. And these are white spheres of light, very intense, and they are described from baseball size to beach ball size, and lots of reports of those, and we even have some video of those things, and some of the video with the object about 3 feet in front of the camera. So the chances of getting a lot of good, solid imaging data are really there. I'll give you two quick examples of what we're dealing with these small light balls. Number one, a couple in their 60s are just driving home at about 11 o'clock one evening, stop the car outside the garage. The lady gets out of the car to kind of guide her husband, you know, as wives do, into the garage. The garage door is starting to open, and all of a sudden their mercury vapor light goes out, and the area is thrown in pitch black. No storms, no clouds, beautiful evening. She looks to her right, and she sees a white sphere of light, no sound, traveling by her head about 4 feet away in the direction of the garage, and it pulls in front of the car, goes to the back of the garage, and hovers, illuminating the garage with this brilliant pure white light. Huh. This thing stays on for several seconds and then vanishes, period. A sort of similar case, two attorneys are standing down in the area watching for the large amber lights, and they're not believers at all. Matter of fact, they're skeptics. And they're standing 10 feet apart, and they see suddenly up in the tree line to the north, about 1,000 feet away, a cluster of small white light balls that are kind of maneuvering around, frolicking around from the ground to the tops of the trees, and two of the lights leave the cluster and start directly towards the two witnesses. They're very low to the ground, and they're traveling along at a good clip. When they're about 150 feet from them, one of the lights makes a right-angle turn, crosses a field, and disappears into a thick cluster of trees. The second light, however, continues and passes between two people standing 10 feet apart at shoulder level, with no air disturbance, no heating, no cooling, no sound, illuminates the two people as they're looking at each other, flies behind them across the field, across the gravel road into another field, makes a right-angle turn, and flies into trees to the west. Now, that is really the typical stuff that's going on.
Incredible. And I notice very assiduously you're avoiding calling them orbs.
Yes. Initially, I was calling them orbs because they sort of fit the profile, but as I see more and more digital photos of cemeteries full of orbs,
yeah,
I didn't want to relate to that at all. That would be totally misleading. These are nothing whatsoever like that, and they're actually being seen by the witnesses, obviously, and photographed. My take is if a video camera will capture something, it's there. Whatever it may be, video cameras are not good at capturing hallucinations. So it's just incredible, and it's incredible we found this second site. where the very same types of things have been going on. And those people, some of them are bankers, lawyers, ranchers, mechanics, and they have no interest in publicity. So they're not making all this stuff up. And I know that for a fact because my wife and I, along with 17 other people one night, witnessed a lot of this stuff, and I was able to get numerous still shots with 35 camera. And the things do produce, on occasion, electromagnetic effects. They ruined a video unit that I had sitting over there surveilling the place all night with the object flying in daylight in front of three witnesses over the camera and burning up the electronics and destroying 15 additional tapes. A brand new Cadillac was sitting there one night, and in the midst of a lot of the large amber displays, the gentleman who is not able to walk was sitting in the Cadillac, and all of a sudden the door locks start locking, unlocking. The radio comes on, starts running stations, and cell phones wouldn't work. It was a quite widespread and intense electromagnetic episode. So you tell me, what are we talking about here?
You mentioned daylight sightings.
Oh, yes.
For some reason, I got the feeling that it was only nighttime. Has anybody made pictures or video of these things during the day?
Yes, yes. As a matter of fact, in our new, soon-to-be-released SIU DVD, we have video taken by the folks over there of the objects in daylight, two metallic objects which were flying east to west, and the lower of the two objects, without stopping, reverses its direction, climbs and passes underneath the upper object in the opposite direction. Two of the large bright ambers in daylight, another large bright amber in daylight. I have charted their observation times versus twilight and sunset, and there have been numerous observations during a light sky. And as a matter of fact, I saw five. It was a very bright twilight. You could see the ground clearly and so on. The owner and I were standing there, and suddenly he said, look at this. And there were three of these circular ambers in a row to the northeast. And I'm standing with my mouth open. Had it been a metallic disc with little guys on it, I would have been fine. But this was so odd and so unexpected in appearance. And within seconds, two additional objects appear to the east, directly east of us. And the fifth object was pretty close. And it was fairly low to the ground. And I had a very, very good view of it. This lasted a minute and 37 seconds. It was an oval vertically. It had the orange, yellow, odd color in the center all over the interior of it. And around the outer section of this thing, in a horseshoe, the top didn't have this dark band. It was like a dark horseshoe around the outer edge of this thing, and it was the weirdest purplish color I've ever seen. I stand there looking at it, and I got to tell you, it sounds crazy. The only thing I could think of was that I was looking at some kind of portal, and I fully expected something to come out of it. And that was the only impression I had of this thing. And I'm so proud because for the minute and 37 seconds, I had my video camera running and pointing at the ground. But I was so totally taken this sight. And the sky was so light that it would have been very easy to see if they were affixed to any other kind of object, if they were hanging on a parachute, if they had wings, anything else. And there was nothing and no sound. And fortunately, three guys, right after they disappeared, drove up in a pickup truck, and they said, did you guys see those five things? So I felt a little better that, you know, I had witnesses.
How often do we hear that story about the camera being right next to me? I was holding it in my hand.
Oh, I know.
It was hung over my shoulder, and it didn't even occur to me to shoot it.
Exactly. And, you know, it seems incredible, but it's not, because, as I say, I've been there. Along those lines, September 1st of last year, I had a call at about 9 o'clock in the evening. The wife of a good friend of mine, one of the entertainers in Branson, was calling to say, Ted, there has been a UFO sighting. It's going on right now, just a couple of miles from you. In the background, I could hear her daughter talking to her boyfriend on the cell phone as he described the object to her. So they told me where this was at. It was 1.8 miles west of where I live. I hung up, jumped in the car with the camera and headed out. And, of course, it was all over by the time I got there. And the main reason was it had moved south. The great thing about this story is the witnesses, a lady, the mother, and her 14-year-old son were driving home along this secondary road. And it's a nice, clear night. And as they're going around a curve, they see to the right over a field and ahead of them two very bright circular lights, and they weren't moving. The kid's hanging out the window of the car watching this thing. The mother continues to slowly drive up until she's right in front of it, and it's hovering over a 60-foot tree. It appears to be about 80 feet off the ground. They had their windows down, no sound whatsoever, no other lights, no form. And these two circular lights were stationary, they estimated, about 4 feet apart. As they watch these, the right light, the west light, raises slightly in position, and they thought it was tilting, an object that was tilting. And it moved away at terrific speed across the field, behind their car, across the road, and disappeared behind trees 2,300 feet away to the northwest. Just after the things had disappeared, her second son, who's 16, drove up and asked, "Mom, why are you sitting in the road?" So they explained what happened. He kind of laughed it off, and then he could see they were serious, and they were really shaken. So they all followed each other on the drive home. Well, it's 3.5 miles to the north, then you have to drop to the east, and then you come around. It's a very curvy, hilly road. And when they got to a point about a mile south of the initial sighting, as they popped the top of a hill, the guys started all screaming, "There they are again." And I later found out it was 3,000 feet ahead of them, down the road and around some curves. They could see through treetops the two lights again. They then pick up speed because they wanted to get another look at them. And as they slid around a curve, there they were, directly above a 60-foot tree, right at the edge of the road. The mother stops her car 40 feet from where they were. The 16-year-old slides his car right up to the ditch beside these things. And he's hanging out the window, and they're less than 100 feet off the ground, looking at them from the underneath. From every view that they had, from the front, the underneath, and the back, they were circular. Same light distribution, same color, same brightness, and again, no sound. He's hanging out the window of his car, talking on his cell phone to his girlfriend, which is what I heard part of, on my phone. So when I was talking to him, I said, "Do you have a camera on your cell phone?" Poor kid, I felt so sorry for him, because then he becomes apologetic. He says, "Oh, my God, what am I? Why didn't, you know?" But he had the perfect shot, several of them. So that's another extraordinary case, and these light balls, in this instance, were about 2 feet in diameter. So you can see why I'm getting extremely interested in those types of cases. They seem to be becoming more prevalent over the past few years, even in physical trace cases, and the larger 1950s, 60s, 70s, even 80s, 30-foot discs are much less reported. So I see a very definite trend in the trace cases, in the landing cases, in the close encounters, where these small things are becoming much more prevalent.
It's almost as if they've stopped sending their manned craft or aliened craft to come and look around, and are now sending little remotes to come and do the job.
Absolutely. And these things are truly, truly puzzling, because the more research that we've done into them, and what they do and how they do it, there's one thing for sure. There is some kind of intelligence on the part of these little lights, or on the part of someone controlling them. And the reason I even mention that is that over at the site, a short distance southeast, 3-4 miles, there is a large farm pond where the people there are reporting the light balls descending into the farm pond. And the water glows with a reddish color, and then when they finally come back out, it goes back without the color. So our SIU team has three of the most experienced divers on the planet, and we're going to do some underwater research with that pond and a couple of others. And what makes it so interesting is up in one of the northern states in 1998, lady driving down the highway, 3 foot white light impacts her car, leaves a yellowish residue on the top of the car, continues to fly away. Phyllis Budinger did analysis at Frontier Analysis. The indication was that this had been submerged in a farm pond within an hour of the impact. And there were definite indications that this thing might be both biological and mechanical. So that's the way I want to go. I'm tired of going in and digging around in the ground after the thing's long gone. I want to be there when this stuff is going on, and that's the whole idea with our SIU team.
And that SIU stands for Special Investigations Unit?
Yes.
In looking at your website at ufophysical.com, mm-hmm. I notice there are images, particularly at the 2007 current research page, of your team, nighttime images, and Debbie and Tom at the dive site, presumably one of the ponds.
Right.
Underwater shots, too.
Oh, yeah.
So there are lots of images for the listener to look at. The one that I find intriguing, and it sort of ties into Tatra, is you guys going into a cave or a cavern.
Yes. And the reason for that is we all love cave exploring. But aside from that,
you said that they had been seen flying in and out of there.
Yes. Exactly. And that also has been reported over in the Noel, Missouri area, which is to the west of where I live, down very close to Arkansas. A friend of mine had posted some of those reports as we were talking with witnesses at this totally removed Marley Wood site. We started to get occasional reports of the lights entering and exiting caves. There are a lot of caves all over the area, and I'm getting the rest of the team experience in cave exploration for the point where we go back to Slovakia.
That's a question I was going to ask, because the last time we talked, and it was on the radio, you had been attempting to raise money to finance that expedition back there.
Yes.
How has that been going?
Well, not well. The website is helping us more than anything has. We've started to receive donations towards that, towards equipment from Marley.
Good.
As a matter of fact, this week just had an extremely generous donation. And the problem we're facing is that with the U.S. dollar, even Eastern Europe is a lot more costly to get to than it was on the two trips I had over there in the past. And we need enough funding to be able to rent for a day or two a helicopter to allow us to make much faster surveillance runs to pin down particular areas from low flights over them. Because the Tatra Mountains are extremely rugged. You remember in the past, I always kidded about, if this goes on much longer, we're going to have to get a couple of donkeys, some log chain, and an old iron lung to get me up into the mountains. And this point is much closer now than it was.
Mm-hmm. And a chopper would be really useful.
Yes, absolutely. Because you spend so much time and you're so limited on the equipment you can carry getting back into this place.
Hasn't History Channel been interested in your work? It seems to me I recently saw some clips of you online at the U.S. History Channel. Am I wrong about that?
No, I've done several of the History Channel shows, and one of them I was so glad to do because the entire hour was based on trace landing cases.
That's the one I'm referring to.
Yeah, and they recreated, it wasn't Spielberg-type recreations, but nevertheless, it got the point across of some of the better cases, Delphos, Langenberg, and Jenkins, and so on. But I was so pleased to finally get that out before a national audience, because trace cases, let's face it, have not had that much exposure nationally other than what I've been trying to do, and you're always talking to a limited audience. But I was contacted just yesterday, two emails from a TV producer I've worked with, a great guy. He is working on a project, and it wouldn't involve the moon shaft, the Slovakian artifact, but it would the physical trace research and so on. And so there may be something coming there. National Geographic expressed some interest in the Moonshaft project. The problem is, in anything that they take over, they take over.
Yeah.
And I'm not turning 100% control over to anyone just to get back there and then let them use the data the way they want. My only interest is, of course, I'd love to see this thing, but to get the proper scientific folks in there and let them do their work and figure out what exactly we have there before we get into some big publicity run. So that's why I'm holding out. And so we're kind of hung up with some very kind, well-heeled benefactor or pulling together donations. That's about the only way we have to go. So it's frustrating because I can assure you right now it's sitting there in that cave and will not be found unless we can make the effort to get over there. And eventually, when I'm dead and gone, which is exactly what Tony Hurok, who found this thing, stated in his diary in 1944, a few decades after I'm gone, it will be forgotten. And now I find myself 30 years later, 38 years later, thinking the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I hate to see that happen. And the importance for history, for archaeology, for God only knows what, is beyond estimate.
A subterranean artifact in Slovakia at the ufophysical.com website, the Center for Physical Trace Research's website. On the Project Moonshaft page, there's a quote from Antonin Horak who says, "I froze in amazement. There stands something like a large black silo framed in white limestone formations. It is a glass-smooth flank of a seemingly man-made structure. And even the thought of a tower-sized artifact embedded in rock in the middle of an obscure mountain is bewildering." And Antonin Horak wrote that October 23rd, 1944, when he and others were hiding from the oncoming German army.
Exactly.
You're going to have to take some miners there, too, aren't you? Because there's been collapse since Antonin was there.
The Russians did a lot of aerial bombing in early 1945 and late 44. The cavern that I was in, that I truly believe has great potential to be the cave. If not, I have two other locations. If you could fly into the area, it would be pretty easy to go through and find the cave. So I have no doubt that we can find it if the cave that I was in is not it. There was some collapse back there. I was by myself, and I was not about to try to go through some very loose and large boulders and wind up staying in there. So that's the problem. But there would have to be some shoring. There is plenty of forest timber outside. And I do have some friends, some good contacts in southern Poland who are willing, very willing, to join us and discreetly carry out the project. So we would have the manpower and the ability to do what we need to do. I don't know. My wife almost every day says, this has got to be done. And she doesn't get all that excited about most UFO cases.
Not many wives do, yeah.
You're right. She was with me when I talked with Tony Hurok and his wife at their home in 1970, and she was able to sit there and talk with his wife and get a lot of insight from her on a totally different level while I visited with Tony. And, of course, after we then went to Las Cruces, met with Alan Hynek, Alan immediately went up there and talked to Tony and his wife, and he said, you know, look, this is something, and we've got to try to get there. And we did have the opportunity in 1970. Of course, now we've gone over all that, and we even had the funding to go in 70. And the Russians had invaded Czechoslovakia in 1968. They were arresting a lot of people. And we had four contacts that could have procured my supplies for me and provided some transportation before I could go. The Russians arrested them, and from the information we finally got was that they were killed. I think not because of the artifact or any interest in it by the Russians, but because they were politically incorrect in Prague at that time.
Mm.
They were sort of the underground and union people, and you didn't want to be that in that period.
No.
Then it was, you know, 1999 before I was given the funding to go, and then in 2001. But being by yourself in a country where you can't speak the language, you can do a lot of historical tracing, which I did, and I gathered a lot of information, and I struggled into the Tatras many, many times. It just takes a team, because you've got to have more equipment and supplies than I could carry.
And a helicopter.
And a helicopter would be a must.
Yeah, and I'm sure Alfred Lemberg would be very happy to fly it for you.
I would be very happy to have him fly it. That would make it an even better trip.
That will be a fascinating trip whenever it happens. I've been saying that for several years now.
You know, I have two.
Yeah.
And I can tell you my two trips over there were pretty fascinating. It's something that I think just has to be done. I can't imagine that we're all sitting around and not really making an effort to do this.
Well, listener, if you have a PayPal account or a checkbook and or even a charge card, there
sure.
is a link at ufophysical.com, which will take you to PayPal, and you can use PayPal or a charge card or mail a check if you'd like to support the work that Ted Phillips and his Special Investigations Unit are doing. You mentioned a DVD, Ted Phillips.
Mm-hmm.
What's the content, and when can we expect to see it or buy it?
We will all be at. I'll be speaking at the Aztec New Mexico Conference March 26th. 7th and 8th, we're all going together, and we're going to do some prowling around at the alleged Aztec 1948 crash site. It's pretty difficult to do anything with a case that old, but since we're going to be there, so we'll be posting some video and images on the website from there, because again, and I want to really emphasize this, we're trying to keep this site up to date and current, so people will have a reason to come back, not just go back and see the same stuff. On the DVD, which we are trying desperately to have available for the conference, and from that point on, they were talking about April 1st, and I said, well, no, that wouldn't be a good date, I don't think. Let's do it the day before or the day after.
Yes.
We don't need that for sure. But the DVD will show some of our team webisodes of our investigations at Marley and in some of the caves. And more importantly, it will include all of our video of the North Mystery Light that we were able to get ourselves, along with all the video that the property owners have shot from 1999 up to the current date. And there is some really incredible stuff there.
Oh, good.
And I've done some slow motion and zoom in where you can actually see some of these things forming, small lights. One of the most intriguing pieces is that you have this large primary object, which they saw for over 8 minutes, three witnesses, and he taped about 5 minutes of this thing. And at one point, the thing is stationary, and coming from the left, you see a bright, small, white light coming in the direction of the large primary. And it is moving. And I had to slow the thing down to get any sense, really, of what it was doing. And when it reached a point fairly close to the primary, without really stopping, it just delays for a split second, it reverses direction, doesn't turn, reverses direction, starts moving away at this tremendous speed. And as it does so, a second object of the same relative brightness comes out of the side of the primary, makes a curve, and comes down in trail of the first object. And several of the clips have that, with these smaller things flying toward, coming out of, flying over, under, and behind the primary object. Fascinating stuff. Fascinating.
I look forward to seeing that, too.
Well, I really think you'll enjoy it.
Once the disc is out, and once you guys have been down to Aztec and are back, let us know, and we'll let the listener know that the disc is available. And
great.
Remind them of the UFOphysical.com site, and they presumably can order it online from there.
Yes. Yeah, and I would hasten to point out, number one, I have always avoided doing a book or selling anything related to this stuff. In the last very few years, I did create some CDs on some of the cases and so on to try to raise some funding toward investigation of this stuff. Well, now, selling this DVD, I have to be honest, I hate to do it because I think it's in some ways demeaning to what we're trying to do, but I just don't know how else to get the funding to pursue these projects. And part of any donations or sales, a good part of that money go to the Marley Project to begin with, because what we're wanting to do is to place two high-res CCD units on a windmill at Site 1, where we have a clear view 24/7 of the primary areas of the activity. It would go directly in streaming video to our website, so you'd be able to click on your computer and watch.
Ah, webcam.
Yeah, absolutely.
Live feed like many places do now.
Yeah.
What a great idea, Ted.
We're starting with, I think, our next visit over there, which won't be long. We plan to send back some sort of webisodes, the team in action, and people can basically go with us. If something happens, they'll see it in real time. Again, I think that's important to document what's going on, because suddenly then you have a lot of extra witnesses that are seeing this happen as we're seeing it happen.
I know you don't like to think about it, but it might behoove you in order to be able to finance the things you need financed to make that a subscription feed.
You know, we have talked about that, and I so hate to have to do that.
I'm hating doing what I'm doing, but, you know, there's no option.
Yeah, at least for the time being, we're trying to hold out for enough donations to make this webcam possible. Of course, this area is so remote, there are no phone lines. So consequently, what we're going to have to do is be able to buy into a provider of a satellite dish.
Yeah, I've had some experience with that. It's not bad, actually.
No.
Not bad at all. The initial outlay in Canadian dollars was about $800.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think it was about $49, $59 a month for a reasonable high-speed connection.
And you see, that's basically all we need because, as a matter of fact, the owners are building us a small building to work out of because they really want to figure out what is going on. They are so confident that we're going to do serious research and not expose them to the general public and yet be able to get this stuff out that they're helping us in just any way they can. And I can tell you, after seeing this stuff personally and after looking at the videos and everything considered, these folks are not flipping a light switch and starting a show. I mean, Spielberg could not produce a thing like this stuff. Well, maybe in an enclosed studio, but not in the outdoors.
No.
And so anyway, that's what we're about. That's what we're trying to do, and not sit in a chair looking at a computer. Well, unless we're looking some evening at the webcam.
Yeah.
But to get out, get in the middle of this stuff and do something and actually produce data and make it available to the public.
And so few people are doing that nowadays.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, Ted, I want to thank you for joining us and filling us in on what's been going on since last we talked. And as I said, once the DVD is out, let us know and we'll put it out there, both on this program and on the UFO updates list. And it will spread from there, I guarantee you.
Well, I certainly appreciate your time and coming back to me so many times.
You always have amazing cases and amazing reports.
I have been my whole life so fortunate to have those come to me. I just can't say how much I appreciate it. I don't really understand why. I don't know. I've fallen into the middle of some really, really incredible cases. I'm appreciative of that. And anytime, my friend, I always thoroughly enjoy doing any of your shows. And I wish you the very best of luck.
Thank you. And to you, too. Well. And by the way, I think that you, like me, have an assignment whether we choose to accept it or not.
You know, my wife has said that to me so many times. She has said, you're supposed to reach this artifact.
Mm-hmm.
Said, well, it had better be soon.
Oh, they're not going to let you go till you've done it.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, Ted Phillips, we'll talk to you soon.
All right, you certainly will.
Good.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
As I was standing looking up one day, enjoying the view across the way, some big bright lights came flying by, a lot of whirling doodads in the sky. It's just imagination, but I saw them just the same.
As I said at the beginning of this program, an interesting couple of weeks. My thanks to Dave Verlott, Stuart Miller, and Ted Phillips. And if the small taste of the Tatra Cave mystery we briefly touched on intrigues you, may I suggest that you grab program 390 and give it a listen while you read the Tatra page at Ted's website, which is linked into this edition's listing. And let's not hold our collective breath till we hear more about Morningstar and Salah's attendees at the UN meeting. Till next time we meet this way, thanks for listening and supporting Strange Days Indeed and the UFO Updates Archive. Bye.
It's just imagination, but I saw them just the same. It's just imagination, but I saw them just the same.
That's this edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to SDI at virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network.